Hey everyone, it's Jim Hoffman here from this Office Hours. I am, of course, joined by Josh Knapp. Josh, are you still with me?
How you doing? I am. How you doing tonight?
All right. I want to thank, of course, anyone listening in, you know, thank them for joining us live on the show. And if you listen to a recording, of course, I appreciate that as well. And if I urge you to spread the word about EMS Office Hours and send your EMS peers over to emsofficehours.com, and they can listen to the archive shows and get all the notes and links and the occasional downloads that are even associated with the shows as well. I did the topic tonight. I thought it would be a good idea to kind of start sort of like a long-running series about protocols and things that we do in them, and you know, whether it's a drug, whether it's a specific treatment that's kind of common, you know, to protocols, and kind of talk a little bit about how they affect patients and how they affect us as providers and the perception of these things that we do, and maybe things that we can do better or improve upon when doing them. So that's why I kind of came up with this little type here. And thought maybe we started out with something easy like nitroglycerin and see how it goes.
All right. Sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah, I don't want to give a big educational thing. I want to kind of just make it more conversational. You know, I mean, everyone out there listening to this podcast, pretty much they've been through this, you know, through this seminar, and they've been through their class in servicings on nitroglycerin and you know how it's used, what it does, and all that stuff. I mean, we'll probably mention it, I'm sure, during the show. But you know, one thing it's interesting, just you know, whenever I do a show here, I always try to do a little bit of research before the show and try to come up with the little nuggets of information or just kind of refresh my own memory of some of the things, you know, that we're talking about so I don't sound like a total buffoon. And, you know, when doing this, one thing that was interesting, which is something I'm going to say this right off the top, it was something I didn't realize. When it comes to nitro spray, I never knew that you could give it on top of or underneath the tongue. It wasn't strictly for sublingually when it came to nitro spray.
You know, I can only speak from personal experience, but the oil, the nitroglycerin oil that they use that they atomize in the spray is really, really potent transdermal stuff. So, you know, they have you spray it under the tongue. Listen, you can give Valium in the oral form under the tongue. As a matter of fact, it's one of the routes sublingually because it will because of its quicker absorption into the system. Just like nitroglycerin, that's why they have you do that under the tongue. But you know, any place that touches your skin, you're going to get it. Just speaking from personal experience, you know, when you handle the nitroglycerin spray, you got to be a little careful because I've definitely been it's transdermal through the calluses in your hands, and if you're not used to it, it can challenge you.
Well, I mean, this is something I saw this over on. I saw that kind of pointed out over on Street Watch and the paramedic blog, and he talks about, you know, that little information as far as it being under, you know, being over, you know, under the tongue or on top of the tongue, and comments that were mentioned in that that blog post and people that commented on that blog post, they said a lot of people were aware of it. Some people were not aware of it. And, you know, comments were made that pretty much the entire mouth is very, you know, accepting to that medication. And actually, if you look at the drug insert itself, the drug insert says spray onto or under the tongue. And then actually in two places where it says to, you know, the direction saying spray on or on the tongue. And also in the instance of the drug as well, it's preferably onto or under the tongue. So I found that interesting, you know, that they stress that the whole nitroglycerin deal. And so I'm not quite sure why, you know, in school they push the sublingual. I don't know if that's maybe just a way to kind of standardize the drug administration route on that. One person had also commented, well, when it comes to even the natural tab and talking about it letting it being absorbed in the mouth by chewing the tab, not necessarily swallowing, but chewing it to break it up so that it let it, the mouth absorb it more rapidly that way. And, you know,
I don't know. I question that only because the tablet is so small. It's 1/60th of a gram. And, you know, you can't absorb – one pathway you will not absorb the drug is through your teeth. And everybody has – you know, nobody has perfect teeth. And
well,
you're going to get
my teeth are pretty perfect.
You know, but – and in the magic of radio, we can see that, Jim.
Well,
so, I mean, you can see my smile right now. But you can't. Yeah, I mean, it'll get. You know, it gets cracked up, and anybody.
Oh,
look,
it is tiny.
You can see the tab. How quick it gets. It goes to powder. How quick it absorbs. You know, I mean, unless the person is really dehydrated, and that's one of the issues you might have. You know,
that's the reason why that comes up. You know, the whole sublingual thing too is that it's amazing how many patients out there can't seem to understand the whole lift up your tongue, you know, request when you go to give these drugs. I mean, I've had a patient where I've said lift up your tongue, and they're pointing your tongue pretty much in every direction other than up. You know, and no matter what I say to them, you know, touch the roof of your mouth with the tip of your tongue, you know, try to touch your nose with your tongue. Anything I try to do,
everything you can, right.
Their tongue is going everywhere but up. I can't get, you know, the spray under the tongue. I can't get the tab under the tongue, you know, and it gets to the point where I feel like they're doing it on purpose to kind of mess with it a little bit, you know.
I remember something I read a long time ago about taking tongue depressors with you for just that purpose when you're giving oral medication so you can get the tongue out of the way. As a helpful little suggestion of, you know, this, you may want to have these with you. And I thought that was
now, is that a,
ridiculous.
Is that an approved device on the ambulance depressor?
Well, that's just what I'm saying is, you know, it's like, you know, people, we come from the world of see one, do one, teach one. And too often we teach, even the good instructors will teach exactly what they are taught. They don't go beyond and say and question what they're taught and say, is there a better way? Is this the correct way? You know, did everything get through? And, you know, so those are the reasons, you know, you're taught sublingually, sublingually, sublingually. You pound it into your students. No, the correct way. And, of course, you know, paramedics aren't finicky about the right way to do something. You know, even if there's 100 different ways to do it, you have one way of doing it correctly.
Yeah.
That was
I've had patients that were, you know, that depended upon that nitroglycerin, especially those CHF patients where, you know, the nitroglycerin is going to, you know, be the one thing that can actually help them. I've actually taken it out of my hand and lit it up for them, you know, of course with gloves. But, you know, it's like to that point where, okay, you know, I can't sit here with new direction on how to pick your tongue up for 5 minutes. I've got to get this medication on board. You know, I looked at a lot of protocols for tonight or two to see. I was just wanted to see how the difference is on protocols. And I looked at in New York City, of course, we're familiar with those protocols, and where I am up here in upstate New York, I've looked at North Carolina. Protocols, try to give myself, a wide berth of protocols. off town and take a look at that. So
now,
what
don't
I,
they go with the AHA guidelines?
Who's that?
The different protocols? I mean, weren't they basically the same or not?
Not necessarily. Most of them will let you give, a lot of them say, you know, you give the nitroglycerin 4 milligrams sublingually every 5 minutes as long as the blood pressure stays usually above 100. Sometimes if the systolic blood pressure is above 90, you can just keep giving the nitro every 5 minutes. Some of them allow you to give 3, you know, without going to the doc, you know, and do 3 sprays or 3 tablets sublingually every 5 minutes. If the systolic blood pressure is holding. And some of them want to have a case where you give first what the pressure is. You know, some of them, just kind of confuses me. And just I want to kind of talk about protocols is how the guidelines kind of go over. If you're a paramedic, you've got to give an IV, the but when it comes to being the ENT, you can actually with that, and I have an IV.
Jim, I'm having some audio issues on my end. I don't know if you can hear me. I'm having audio issues on my end, and it just sounded like you were speaking through a fan. So everything you just said, I'm not hearing. I'm going to hang up, and I'm going to call from a landline. All right?
Okay.
I'll talk to you in a minute.
Sure. Well, while Josh tries to square away those audio issues, hopefully it's his end and not mine, and that's my mic that's giving some issues tonight. Just let him call back, but, you know, just in case you don't know out there, if you're listening, you know, just as a little refresher, that nitroglycerin, usually we're giving that because the rationale is that it's going to vasodilate the circulation, both sides of it, the systemic circulation. It's going to also help reduce preload, or that venous return, and also help the reducing the afterload as well, which is any of that forward resistance that you're getting. So that's the rationale of giving it, because what we're trying to do is reduce that workload on the heart and you know, help reduce oxygen consumption. And you know, this is what we're trying to do to try to help that heart not work as hard. You know, and some people also think, well, that it's going to also help to vasodilate coronary circulation also, to help that, and that's going to help the delivery of oxygen and help the you know, that delivery to the tissues that are having a problem getting enough oxygen to them. So, you know, but the one thing that's important to note is that even though you're getting this vasodilation and it's helping reduce that preload and all, it's not going to do anything for a patient who's got a complete obstruction, you know, from say a clot or something like that. So just want to keep that in mind, you know, when we're talking about giving nitroglycerin to patients. What the rationale is why we're giving it, along with the having that in the back of your mind that you know, you can't really do anything for a blockage. You know, how much nitrogen you're getting. That's just what we do. We do things with 12 bleed and like that. So, Josh, I guess you're back on with me.
Yeah, how are you hearing me now?
I can hear you okay.
Okay. So I just heard the tail end of what you were saying. You were talking about that, you know, even nitro is not going to help you with a complete blockage?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to do anything to correct a complete obstruction. You know what I mean? It's not
Right.
going to help. It's, you know, so I was just kind of just giving a little, while we call back in, I was just going over just the rationale of why we have it as far as it violating and, you know, helping reduce the preload and all that good stuff,
You
just
know,
in
there's an
case.
excellent article. I think it's on either EMS One or on EMS Today or one of the EMS online magazines. And it's on the right ventricular infarct and nitroglycerin. And what's even kind of interesting is that they mention that in the new ALS guidelines or in the new American Heart guidelines that they're not even, unless the person is hypoxic, they're not even saying supplemental oxygen. You know, you want to talk about a cardinal rule. Although they say there's nothing wrong with it and won't cause any harm, they're also saying, hey, there's no need for it. And then they're getting away. They're basically breaking apart Mona except for the aspirin. And about
right.
the only part that, you know, they're staying behind is the aspirin on this. And it's kind of interesting. Although, and, you know, with a cautionary note, anybody's listening to this, that doesn't mean not to use nitroglycerin by any stretch of the imagination. It's definitely a drug that works. It's definitely a drug within our protocol, and it's something to be used, you know, correctly. But, you know, keep in mind, it's not the, as you were saying, it's not the cure-all. It's not the panacea, and there are cases where you may want to be careful with its use and with its application.
Yeah.
I thought when you originally, you know, I got to say, you know, there was one aspect when you set up this conversation, and it's like, you know, what the hell do you do? Do you listen to my jobs or you know, my job call, my call logs or what? Because I was actually, I was on a job on Friday, and I had a run-in with a physician. What a surprise! And I get called in for a chest pain. 38-year-old woman. You know, all the nothing really fit the common profile, but she did have borderline blood pressure. You know, or was complaining of faintness. We didn't know that she had borderline blood pressure, and the doctor had already given her a nitro and had her on a nasal cannula, which I always think is funny. But then, you know, I walk into the room. He's called me. I'm the paramedic, and he goes, and I say, Doc, would you hold off on that, you know, I just want to get some vitals, and, you know, would you hold off on that nitro? And he immediately turns to me and yells in my face. I mean, an inch away from my face. It was quite an interesting situation. He says, who's the doctor here? Are you the doctor here? And, you know, it's like at that point in time, what do you do? Explain to him what, you know, your local protocols suggest that unless you are a REMAC physician, stand aside. You know, you're not going to tell him
that's
that.
Not gonna work well.
Yeah. And he basically walked up to the patient with his nitro in his pocket, and he pulled it out and he put it under her tongue, and I'm like, you know, thanks a lot, because now if anything else is going wrong, you've just complicated this mess. So, you know, this is a little bit, is you know, why did you pick this topic right now? I don't know, but you know, that I had that type of call right when you picked this topic. I think that we have to correlate, you know, so I'm just more prepared when you pick a topic, okay?
Well,
it's
funny because, you know, like you said, it's part of, and not just with this drug, I mean, any drug that we give, we have to base what we're doing on the patient's presentation, you know, and not necessarily to say, well, you know, basing a presentation, what we're doing as far as something, you know, cardiac pain versus maybe musculoskeletal pain, something like that, because even reading some of the stuff that I've been reading lately, well, that nitroglycerin might even help a person who's not having cardiac chest pain. They might have some relief, you know, from that. So, you know, we have to take the whole picture into consideration, like you said, and that includes vital signs and 12 leads and the patient's history and what medications they're on and all that before we give the drug. Because, you know, think about how we've got drugs out there now like Cialis and Viagra and you know, how there's all these warnings about giving nitro to patients that are on these drugs when you, you know, sometimes, but you get patients who will be having chest pain after having a sexual encounter and using these drugs. And so now what do you do? You know what I mean? Because now you've got a patient who's already taken that drug, you know, maybe had some type of sexual encounter, and now they're having pain, you know, from it, and now you can't give them nitro because it has been 24 hours or 48 hours they've taken, you know, the Viagra or the Cialis.
Right, right. And the interesting thing is, you know how those drugs were developed. They were developed not for cardiac, but for respiratory.
Right, right.
You know, and so it's kind of funny. They were developed to help you oxygenate better, and that's sort of how they work. You know, they increase blood flow to certain organs. It just doesn't happen to be your heart. Mm-hmm. So it's the old male conundrum, you know, where do you
right.
want the blood to go? And nobody ever says the brain. I always love that part, you know.
You know, everyone's the last place they want to go to, right?
Right, exactly, exactly.
You know, it's funny, you talk about having the call with the doctor that is kind of bypassing your training, bypassing your
bypassing
treatment
everything.
Guidelines. Yeah.
Bypassing, you know, all a treatment. I mean, basically, just to throw nitro into somebody's mouth is just crazy. And he didn't give her aspirin or anything else. I mean, it was one of those. I mean, it was like a call back to the 50s. I'm not sure if he's read a medical journal since then. But, you know, one or two things have changed.
Think about how, like, even since I even went to medical school, when I was in medical school, they never talked about things like, you know, right-sided, you know, MIs and not giving insurance, you know, to those types of patients, you know. But nowadays, you've got now, if you have inferior wall MI, they tell you that, you know, you probably shouldn't be given nitro because it's more likely a high chance of it being right-sided MI.
Well, you know, a caveat here, and because I ran into this with a medic I was working with the other day, it's like, you know, they were talking, he was telling me about a job, and he said, and the person gave nitro, even though the guy had a massive inferior. And I'm like, well, so what's the problem? You know, and it's like, well, you're not supposed to give nitro to an inferior wall MI. And I'm like, no, it's that, you know, right-sided MIs commonly go with inferior MIs, but they don't inferior wall MIs. But it's not vice versa. And if you diagnose one thing and the person, you know, fits all the other criteria, that's not a reason to withhold. So, you know, it's like, again, our community of legend overrules the community of fact.
I think, but in his defense, though, I think now a lot of docs, a lot of people out there, their thought process is, you know what, with, you know, they're saying something like 50%, 30 to 50% of people that are having an inferior wall, you know, might also be having, you know, that right ventricle, you know, involvement going on. So it's better to just stick with the aspirin, stick with the oxygen, maybe, you know, or something like that, you know, and you know, not take a chance and dropping their blood pressure, you know, by doing that and even putting them into a fatal arrhythmia, you know what I mean, if you fail
right.
or attack,
right.
whatever. So, because even a lot of people say, too, well, you know, I can go right side at 12 lead, and I can see maybe if there's elevation in V2 to V4, V6 or whatever, and see maybe if it is indeed right-sided, you know, episode going up, you know, that inferior wall. But it's not really going to change treatment, you know, when it comes to that, because I'm still going to be hesitant in giving that nitroglycerin. Because you're taking a chance, you know, that if you say, okay, well, maybe this is the 50% that's not having, or, you know, right side involvement. Then, you know, if having it, then you tonight you probably be right on blood pressure. But they have having any big chance of sending that person to a legal situation that you know it's hard to come out of. You know, I guess that's
Jim.
Yeah.
I hate to break in. I'm sorry, but your audio is just completely crispy. It's like speaking through a fan again. I got every other word.
Okay.
Now I'm hearing you. What were you saying? It's like, I mean, are you basically saying, look, you know, show caution, or that that an inferior wall is close enough to a right-sided MI that?
Well,
you know,
I think it's something that I would probably definitely caution on.
Well, caution, yeah.
Most protocols not going to say. Most protocols don't say, okay, well, if it's inferior, you know, withhold. You know, a lot of them base it upon, which is why most protocols have that little blood pressure situation.
Right.
Because
right.
They're covering themselves. Okay, well, if the patient's blood pressure is that low and they appear to be having MI, more than likely it's probably going to be right-sided, and you don't want to keep giving them nitro and turn the blood pressure even more. Even the American Heart Association, I think, as well, says that even if they're hypertensive with chest pain symptoms, I forget what it is.
And it's an inferior wall MI, you should be cautious with
nitro. Yeah, inferior wall, I'm talking about, I think, if it drops, it was something like below
120?
30, like 30, below 30 numbers. If it drops more than 30 below what the patient normally start, what the patient started out at.
Right.
So if they was 180 over 90, and now they're, 140 over 80 or something like that, then you should, start thinking about what's going on with the patient, because it was way too much to drop with nitroglycerin. That might actually be something else that causing the patient's pressure to drop, so rapidly, with just nitro.
And I'm not going to be a pill about this, and we don't need to beat this one to death. But what you're saying again is you're saying you're assessing your patient, you're looking at your patient, you're reassessing your patient, and these are all the things that we should be doing anyway. I mean, I've seen too many times where people get sloppy with this in the field, but mm-hmm. if you think about it, look at all these great tools that we have, especially in this monitor, that 10 years ago, there were people who didn't have cardiac monitoring. They just didn't have it on the bus. So,
right.
They weren't even able to tell what we're able to tell. We're not working as much in the dark as we used to. Yeah, we don't have a chem lab. We don't have iStat. But we can tell a lot of what's going on. And, you get the clue. Clue number one, you have 2-3 in AVF. Elevated ST segments. All right, so you have an inferior wall. You know now that inferior walls go hand in hand with right. You are able to check and reassess their blood pressure. You're able to check and reassess their skin signs. Hey, are you going to withhold because they're having chest pain and an inferior wall? No, but you're going to be damn well cautious with it. Maybe
right.
more cautious than you would be with a septal or,
like you said, too, you're going to go take your assessment and go over what the patient's complaint is, how they're presenting, their history, their medications and all. And the thing where you're suspecting that, I think you'd probably be get more benefit out of calling the doc and bouncing off your assumptions with him, and whether or not to withhold that nitro or maybe not give as much as the nitro, then start to do a right-sided, 12 lead.
Right.
I think a lot of medics will just do it because, look how smart I am. I'm doing what? Right,
a lot of medics might not do it because they don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Though it's just flipping the leads and throwing them on the other side, there are going to be guys who, are saying, or they've taken Paige's course and they know about taking the leg lead and all that other crap.
Yeah.
But we're still back at the same spot. We have our assessment skills. We know that nitro should be cautious in this. But is there – one of the things I was sort of interested about, and I was looking – and I know that you always dig up these little factoids, which makes these calls kind of really interesting sometimes – is, what were some of the, I was trying to sound a little bit more intelligent than I usually am, and that's a trick. That's a stretch for me in the first place. But I was doing a little internet research, and I came up with some interesting off-label applications for Nitro.
Oh, yeah.
And, I don't think that we'll ever have to worry about treating an anal fissure in an emergency situation other than, tamponade, and I'm not sure I'd want to do that. But there was some interesting stuff with peds and nitro paste. And I've always known this one, is that if you take a little bit, like you're having trouble raising a vein for an IV access, you can sort of... Have
I've
you
heard
ever
that.
Had success with that? Because I've never tried that.
I never tried it.
Okay.
But I'm phenomenal with these, so I don't have to worry about that type of stuff.
Okay. So you know about it, but you've never tried it.
No, I've heard of. Yeah, I've heard of. When I've done like IV, did an IV guide a few years ago. I did one that I have on the state. During that research, from the people, that was one of the things that they mentioned. That they've tried, for patients. I didn't think it to come up that way. But I've never tried it, though.
I'll make you a bet there's a trick to it as well, that it doesn't work like on ACs, but it will work on a hand vein.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be something to that, too, because, I tried it. When I tried it on an arm vein, a forearm, and I didn't get anywhere. So I was just, it was.
You talk about the uses for it, and we mentioned the sublingual and the spray, and I see like nitro paste though seems to be getting pulled from a lot of headlines.
Right.
It seems that the thought on that is that it's no like set rate of absorption because of different patient sizes and things like that. So I guess they're taking it out because there's no way to, I guess, figure out how much the patient's getting and, how fast or how slow and things like that. Some of them say, go ahead, you can't, put an inch of paste or inch and a half of paste or whatever. But they're saying that a lot of that, though, nowadays is not, really showing that it's not really reliable.
Your dosage isn't reliable. Whoop. I mean, what happened to titrate to effect? What happened, how many times have you put paste on somebody, they've come down, everything started to work, and then you take the paste off? I mean, because their blood pressure was starting to, dip a little bit further than you felt comfortable with. It was maybe 160, 170. The symptoms of APE have gone away. They're feeling much more comfortable, much better. You're in transit to the hospital, and their blood pressure is now south of 120. So you take the patch off, and you can always put it back on. But, you have something that you can control there. Now, they've taken it out, and I just sit there and I know that when I had an ER doc lecture me for a half an hour on why it was wrong that they took the nitroglycerin out, and in between all this, it's like, doc, I got to get back out. And, the other part is, doc, I have no control over this. But
the thing is, he was
furious. I mean, it's like, why take paste out? It's so useful.
Well, like you said, too, I mean, nitroglycerin really is one of those drugs. It's one of those titrate drugs. It's one of the ones that we should be, doing and stopping or continuing, based on our reassessment of the patient, continual reassessment of the patient, figuring out if the patient needs any more or if we should stop, doing it. So
onset is like immediate, but what's the duration? It's like 5 minutes, right?
What's that for the paste?
For just nitro is once you stop administering nitro, like you give somebody a spray, how long does that spray last? Like 5-10 minutes?
Well, I think it's I don't know about 10 minutes. I mean, it's not really it's not, I don't think it's the type of drug that lasts that long. I don't have the exact number on that. Usually they want you to repeat it, 3 to 5. So I'm guessing 5 minutes is probably when it's going to start probably to lose its effectiveness. It's going to, when the next dosage is due. But at the same time, I mean, you've got you know, things like the other thing that we use NITRO for too, like CHF patients, where some guidelines say to give, 3 to 5 sprays one time and repeat that every, 5 minutes, whereas
right.
chest pain is one spray and repeat every 5 minutes. So, I guess it's the doses as well, in correlation to what the patient's, presentation is, what's going on with them, because looking at some of the, some of the protocols, one had to give the nitro spray, and you can repeat it, only 2 times for chest pain, but if you've got a CHF patient, you can repeat it 4 times.
Right.
Again, this is based upon the patient's blood pressure and how they're presenting and all, what about, have you ever given it through IV at all, Josh?
No, I've never used it in the field that way. And, it's funny that,
you aren't critical now, right? So
right.
I just wondering if you've seen it.
I definitely transport cardiac patients on nitro. Definitely
okay.
have done it. And, the thing that you have to watch with that when in transport, when you have long transport times and they're on a nitro drip, is their stability. Is, how – but first of all, look in their history. Is this something new to them, or is it something that, that they're old hats at? Because one of the things about nitro is you build up tolerance to it and resistance to it. So, there might be one person that you have a nitro drip running on, and they've never had nitro before, and they're showing all the signs and symptoms, the headache, the low blood pressure, everything else. And you got to watch them and reassess them, because the nitro can build up too quickly, or it can, it can certainly be not enough, but that's, you need to get on the phone with the doc. But if you see their blood pressure crashing on a nitro drip, you got to stop it. You got to treat the patient, in route on what you're doing. I mean, even if it's temporary stopping it,
There are side effects where they have to consider. You said common things, throbbing headache, or some dizziness,
mm-hmm.
Flushing. Even sometimes they they'll complain of burning under the tongue, stuff like that.
Right.
That consideration is being the side effect that they might have, and it's something you probably should let the patient know when you're giving it. I usually tell them, listen, this might give you a bit of a headache.
Yeah.
But it's like a trade-off. Is it, you want a headache, or you want, to have a heart attack type thing? You know what I mean?
Well, the other aspect is now they're expecting a headache. I have for many, many years now told patients when I'm putting them on a backboard that even if they're not having back pain now, that after about 20 minutes, they're going to have back pain. And that's just the way backboards work. And there seems to be a little bit, in some patients, I get a little bit more positive result. In other patients, they're on there 5 minutes and they're saying they're having back pain. The same thing goes with the nitro. And, it's like, I know when I was exposed, and I'll tell you something, if you've never been exposed to nitro, I'm not suggesting you go out and spray yourself with it, but it's an interesting experience. And, make sure you're not someplace you can fall down. That's all I gotta say if you're gonna be exposed. But I broke out. I went. I definitely had a drop in my blood pressure, and I broke out into all the signs of shock, and then I had this horrible headache afterwards. I mean, it was just miserable. And one of the things I was reading up on is that. Say it again.
Did you have an upset or anything? Yeah.
Hello? Oh, crap. Hello?
Yes.
Jim, you broke up on me, and I've lost you. I think... And I'm dialed in now. I don't hear you. One last time. Are you there?
I can't hear me.
I hear you now. Okay, you're back. Yeah, this is we got to talk to the cable company tonight. This is a real bad connection this week.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. couldn't say. Well, I guess during a little, we had some people in there missed their call. We have you call and give it another try out, I bring you into the call. We have plenty left in the show. So, talking about the ID on that job, the IDX, I actually get that when I was in Jersey. When I worked in New Jersey, we used to give the trial via ID a lot.
You used to give nitrolized. Wait, was it in a pre-mixed bag?
No, we used to have to draw it up, put it into a bag, and put it into an IV pump. I think this caller back. Let me see if I can bring. I don't want them to hang up again.
If you got a caller, definitely pick them up.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. Who's this?
Jim, Randy Krause, down in Florida. How are you?
Hey, Randy. How you doing?
All right, hey, keep losing, man. Terrible connection.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. So what's going on? Listen to the show at all tonight?
Yeah, I caught in late, and like I said, you're going in and out, so I'm having a hard time. But I think you bring up a lot of good stuff about the use of nitro. You know, with the right side of MI is definitely a concern. You know, down here we actually we use a tridal drip, and we have pretty good success with it.
Now, do you use the nitro drip in the field in emergent situations or on transport?
Yeah, during transport, we're actually a barrier island. So, you know, we'll use the spray to get you to that therapeutic level. And we're a barrier island, so our closest hospital is a good 15 minutes away. So, yes, it's definitely used more in the transport, you know.
Right.
But we have good success with it. We use 25 milligram bottles pre-mixed in the D5W, run through a pump. You know, start out usually at probably at 10 mics and titrate it up, you know. And like you were saying, it's that balancing act with the blood pressure and everything. And, you know, we've had pretty good success with it.
Right. So, you know, you just, it's not, and I was thinking about what I was saying about DCing it, you know, in route. And we don't DC it per se, but we definitely dial it back. And you're going for that titrated effect, you know.
Right.
As long as you're paying attention, there's no harm. You know, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a drug. Go ahead.
And that's one of I think you touched on a key point, and, you know, you guys had a great show last week. Talking about misadministering medications, the biggest thing is monitoring your patient. You know, that's a lost art.
What an idea, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, keeping an eye on what's going on, using all your tools. You know, I mean, just even looking at the patient, and I mean that art is just gone.
It's gone. It's not even gone. It's just disappearing. And there's I think it's still with those of us who rely on that skill, but I think that especially when you get into the ED and on the upper floors, you know, it seems that they don't look at the patient anymore. They're looking at the blood spectrums and the monitor readouts, and they're not looking at the patients. You know, I don't know. You know, maybe this is for Jim for another show, another day. But you know, it's an aspect that we need to sort of revitalized for sure. And when you're talking about drugs like nitro, you know, a simple, basic drug. I mean, it's the drug everybody grew up with, you know, and it's been in use for, you know, hundreds of years now. And, well, 100 years now, you know, since the invention. But it's, you know, what's the cardinal rule? Look at your frickin' patient. Duh.
I agree. You know, and even though, you know, Jim's touched on in other shows within, all the tools are great, you know. It's those basics that I think we get away from. You know, I noticed you guys, one of the topics tonight was that you see a nitro administration in BLS protocols now.
There is, well, it's always been in the New York area, it's always been in the BLS protocol as you could assist the patient with nitro if they have it.
Right.
I know that that's still a – now you can give nitro if they have it. If they have a script and they have the drug on hand, BLS, in my area anyway, doesn't carry it. But if you are a cardiac patient, you have nitro on you, we can take it out and give it to you whether you're taking it or not.
But my question on that, too, with that is that, you know, you talk about giving the, letting the BLS give it with giving the patient and helping the patient self-administer it. You know, what's to say the patient's not having that right-sided MI? What's to say, you know, what how the patient's presenting is? And yet, with a lot of ALS protocol, they want us to have an IV in place before we even, you know, consider giving it, no matter what the patient's blood pressure is. But then on the other end, you know, under the same state, the same region or whatever, it'll say, well, you know, the BLS can help the patient give it.
Oh,
the medic is there. You know, the medic is there. They can't give it until they have an IV in place. But the EMT is there. They can help the patient take their own. As well, the EMT doesn't have as much training as medics do. They don't have as much, you know, knowledge, apparently, as fully that medic have. You know, go ahead and do it without even, you know, considering the entire patient presentation and even knowing something of what to look for. You know what I mean?
Right. Hey, Tim, in the REMAX protocols, do you guys have a guideline as far as how low the BP is before you stop administering? Like, Lars is 100, even though we know
Well, you're looking at all the different regions. I mean, most of them are 100. There's a few that are 90. You know, say 90, can't be anything below 90. So it depends upon, you know, what region, you know, you're looking at. But most of them, you know, I mean, it's only 10. You know, it's 10 numbers, honestly.
Yeah, right. And really even an automated cuff, like, that's actually better than manually taking a BP. I'm sorry. I apologize to anybody listening to that. You know, even if you're taking a BP, how often are you 10 off from, or, you know, from somebody else taking it? You know, how often,
right.
Just in between taking it, you know, the BP can change. But, you know, that's a great point, is that, you know, how come they get to do it? But keep in mind, they're limited to usually like two or three doses.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not that I'm jealous that they're able to do it. I'm just trying to, you know, point out that, you know, that it's like there's nothing uniform. You know, and looking at, you know, I didn't look at every in the country, but I looked at about maybe, you know, four or five different areas of the country protocols for chest pain. Some are more identical. Some of them let you give sprays and you got to call a doc, and some of them let you give unlimited, you know, sprays on the blood pressure holds. Some of them want you to give an IV, you can even start doing it. You know, some of them want aspirin for nitro, and, you know, nothing was consistent. You know, everything seemed to change. So I found that kind of interesting as well. I'm getting prepared for tonight as well, just kind of noticing that they're very similar, you know, in the way they want you to treat the patients, but none of them are actually, you know, 100% identical. So that was kind of interesting, you know. I think also, too, a lot of areas, too, I mean, where they have EMIs that still work in their region, and they kind of have different guidelines for an EMTI than they do for an EMTP, you know what I mean? So they have to kind of throw that kind of buffer between the basic and the medic is like an in-between treatment guideline as well for some areas. So I thought that was interesting also.
And when you call for medical control, you sometimes get it automatically. You know, it doesn't matter. It's just, you know, either medic to medic or EMT to EMT. You know, it depends on the doc you get. I mean, I know docs that give pain management of use what your judgment says and call me back, and I know docs who give you, you know, a milligram of morphine for a 300-pound patient. So, you know, there's so many variables in our field, and that sort of brings us back to what we were discussing last week, Jim. It's just, you know, the key to all of these questions is the idea of patient assessment, using our patient assessment skills, using the skills that we're allowed to have that are uniform and universal, and then, you know, hopefully pushing for universal protocols across the board, you know, across the states. I don't know what the answer, you know, I don't want to get back into that conversation, but, you know.
You have 10 minutes.
Yeah. But, you know, we're back there, and it's, you know, we're strapped again with, you know, every time you pull out a drug, no matter how simple it is, and now this new thing that I was just reading about, the idea of oxygen on cardiacs. I mean, I wonder when that's going to trickle down to our level where they're going to say, well, don't give oxygen. I mean, now, or oxygen's a oxygen, you know, up to your own judgment. I mean, you know, it's something that's kind of basic and probably doesn't hurt, and maybe it's just an assenting opinion right now. And, you know, you got to keep in mind that medicine is, you know, they call it the study of medicine because it's not a perfected, it's not the perfection of medicine. So, you know, these things will change as we go along, you know, and there's an aspect of that we have to stick to the original end of this of do no harm.
Right. It's interesting that you bring that point up with the oxygen in chest pain or cardiacs. We actually, down here in our countywide protocols, actually started following the AHA recommendations of the O2 saturation being at 94% or above, that we're not administering supplemental oxygen. As long as the patient is not exhibiting signs of hypoperfusion, shortness of breath, or anything like that, as long as they're hemodynamically stable and their O2 sac could be at 94, we will not administer the O2 now because it's showing all these studies of the over-oxygenation actually causing more issues. But it's interesting that you bring that up because that's a hot topic with a lot of people.
Maybe that's a topic next week, Jim. But, there's broad studies now that are saying that over-oxygenation is dangerous, but what are we talking about? Somebody who's been, you know, 5 hours in a hyperbaric chamber before you got to them, or just breathing through a non-rebreather when they're under an emergency stressful situation?
Like I said, it's in the AHA guidelines that is what drives a lot of our cardiac guidelines. They're saying the over-oxygenation with the cells. It's a whole big study. I couldn't get too in-depth with it. As far as the hyperbaric stuff, that's obviously, you know, used with different circumstances. So with that, you need that high oxygen concentration.
I'll take a peek and see if I can find the AHA link for that, so people can maybe check that out and see the details on that, because it is something that I think is coming around the bend and something that I think wind up taking up more conferences and stuff as we go along, discussion and the discussion and all that, you know, and of course the logistics and all that. I think it's going to be another hot topic that's going to be, coming around and people are going to be talking about for a while, especially since that's what we've been doing for how long now?
Yeah,
there's never been any question about oxygen. That's the one thing. Well, if you can't figure what's happening with the patient, you're not quite sure, put them on oxygen, monitor the Valsartan, and get them to the hospital, you know.
Right.
They're looking to, you know, eat that at this point. You know, but I think there's a plus and minus to that, too, because I think that forces us as well to reassess our patients. You know, when you think about it, and it goes not just to that, but again, even just to the oxygen, we're forced to assess patients that, you know, what's their saturation? Are they showing signs of poor perfusion? Are they really short of breath? What are their lung sounds like? All this, you know, ties into whether or not we're going to get or not a medication, and I think that goes for anything. You know, and oxygen, of course, is something teaching. It is a drug and all that crap, but, you know, and people just act like it's always just, you know, air come out of a bottle. But, you know, it is, you know, to a point, it is a drug. So what did you think of doing it, giving it, and why are you giving it? You know, so, yeah, stuff like this kind of forces us to kind of look into that and consider what we're doing for our patients.
I think you got a great point there, Jim.
Yeah, something like that. Sometimes I joke. might hurt after that, though. So I don't know. I'm kind of tight on that one. All right, listen, I only got about maybe four plus. Randy, anything else you wanted to comment on before we end it out, or?
No, I'm definitely going to start listening to you. I'll try to give you a call and let you know how things down here in the deep south may contrast with what you guys do down there, because as I've learned coming down here into Florida, I definitely went on paramedic school in Pluto. So I might have some interesting opposition as things you say as far as what's done down here.
Sure.
But, yeah. Definitely stay in touch, and hopefully you get a better connection. I keep losing you. I don't even know if I'm still right now.
Randy, you actually sound okay, so I think that it's on Jim's side. Have you been able to hear me throughout the show?
I've been hearing you fine. Jim's breaking up on me a lot. So
Breaking up now, or did that clear up?
No, I'm hearing you'll be good for 30 seconds, and then you're out.
I'm not sure my connection up here. I'm in the mountains, so, you know, sometimes we don't
have cable bill, you hick.
We don't have high tech, you know, phone lines and cable lines up here. You know, a couple
of
those
two strings
cans out there.
Two cans and a string.
Exactly.
I will enjoy talking to you guys, and I'll be in touch next week.
All right,
Randy. Thanks for calling in.
All right, Josh. All right, Jim. Have a good weekend. Be safe.
Talk to you later.
All right.
Well, Jim, you got it. You got it now. You know, it's not just me. It's it was on your side there.
I'm not sure what it is. I mean, do I still sound broken up? No.
You come in, like he said, you about 30 seconds, and then you start to break up. I think it's just a cable repeater got soaked in the rain
on
your side.
I haven't noticed that because I'm on a hard line now, so I shouldn't be breaking up. So I don't know why.
No, you sound a little bit better right now, actually. So.
I think it's might be the Blog Talk Radio connection is probably the online thing. That's probably what it is. Probably not even the phone line, you know, or Skype or anything like that we normally use. So I don't want to bore anybody with our connection issues. So I think what we'll do, we'll just end it here. I only got about 2 minutes left anyway, just so thanks for calling in, of course. I appreciate you hosting with me and taking the time out on busy Sunday evening to chime in about these topics. I think they're important for everyone. I think hopefully, if nothing else, I'm hoping we're at least kind of maybe reaching people to ethics, you know, kind of setting them to remember that they have to do it, not just follow a protocol and not just, you know, whip out a drug because the patient has a specific complaint. We have to assess the patient to think about what we're doing for them, you know, whether it's a drug or just even if it's just a simple transport. So I'm hoping we're getting that much out of it and people point in that direction at least.
Yeah, amen on that. And the only thing I'd add to that is you come across a scene where there's another healthcare provider before you got there, and they're administering drugs just because they, you know, it's in their protocol or that's the way they were trained. It's just
right.
Something now you got to take it to the next level, and you got to be extra aware because you know those things are on board.
Sure.
That's a great point.
Document so that the hospital knows what was going on. You know, it's important
and,
stuff too.
You
let them know what happened before you got there.
Keep in mind in our protocols that we can ask for the doc's ID, the doc's license number and their full name for our documentation. And, you know, in my case, I did that and the doc refused. I called for a boss and he put it.
That's
well,
fine.
You know what? I'm not going to take that hit. You know, I'm going to take care of my patient. I'm going to do the right thing for my patient. If drugs were administered because he has a heavy hand, that's his deal. That's his license, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. All right, Josh, let me end it there and round this up, and I guess hopefully we'll see you next week.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. It was good talking to you.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
All right, take care.
I mentioned, of course, thanks for joining me tonight or listening to the recording. You have some information or topic you want to discuss here on EMS Office Hours, be sure to send me an email to jhoffman@ems-safety.com, and I'll be sure to try to get your topic and what you want to talk about here on the show. and you know, get what's concerning you as an EMS provider out there to the masses, hopefully, and get the discussion started. Any comments, of course, also permanent blog notes below, or send that email I just gave you. And as always, this is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours. Until next week, stay safe, guys.